Ellen Howell Company, had been allowed to sit in the commander's chair. Peterson was visiting the facility with Bell & Howell's president, Charles H. Percy, and Thomas J. Watson, Jr., the president of IBM. The first B-Muse radar complex, located at Thule Air Base, Greenland, had come online that week, and the numerical threat levels of the new warning system were being explained to the businessmen. If the number one flashed in red above the world map, unidentified objects were traveling toward the United States. If the number three flashed, the threat level was high. SAC headquarters and the Joint Chiefs of Staff had to be notified immediately. The maximum threat level was five, a computer-generated warning with a 99.9% certainty that the United States was under attack. As Peterson sat in the commander's chair, the number above the map began to climb. When it reached four, NORAD officers ran into the room. When it reached five, Peterson and the other executives were quickly escorted out and put in a small office. The door was closed, and they were left there believing that a nuclear war had just begun. The vice commander of NORAD, Air Marshal C. Roy Slaman, a dapper Canadian with a small mustache, managed to track down the head of NORAD, General Lawrence S. Cooter, who was in an Air Force plane above South Dakota. "Chief, this is a hot one," Slaman said. "The B-Muse indicated that the Soviets had launched an all-out missile attack against North America. The Joint Chiefs of Staff were on the phone awaiting confirmation. The United States had only minutes to respond." "Where is Khrushchev?" Slaman asked his officers. "Khrushchev's in New York today, at the United Nations," NORAD's chief of intelligence said. Slaman immediately felt relieved. The Soviet Union was unlikely to launch an attack that would kill the first secretary of its Communist Party. 20 minutes passed, and no Soviet missiles landed. The three businessmen were led out of the small office, glad to be alive. When news of the false alarm leaked to the press, the Air Force denied that the missile warning had ever been taken seriously. Percy, who later became a Republican senator from Illinois, disputed that account. He recalled the sense of panic at NORAD. A subsequent investigation found the cause of the computer glitch. The B-Muse site at Thule had mistakenly identified the moon, slowly rising over Norway, as dozens of long-range missiles launched from Siberia. Both of America's early warning systems were deeply flawed, and as a result, the most reliable indicator of a Soviet attack might be the destruction of those systems by nuclear blasts. Bomb alarm system sensors would be placed at the SAGE direction centers and at Thule. By the time those bomb sensors went off, however, the president might already be dead. Of the 14 potential successors, as specified by Congress, only the vice president and the secretary of defense would have any familiarity with the PSYOP. If all 14 were in Washington, D.C. during a surprise attack, they would probably be killed or incapacitated. Amid the confusion, it might be impossible to determine who was America's commander-in-chief. Everyone on the presidential succession list had been given a phone number to call in case of a national emergency. The call would put them in touch with the Joint War Room at the Pentagon. But telephone service was bound to be disrupted by a nuclear attack. The Pentagon might no longer exist, and even if it did, the first person to call the War Room might be named President of the United States, regardless of whether he or she was next on the list. WSEG Report No. 50 outlined the problem. "There is no mechanism for nor organization charged with locating, identifying, and providing essential defense communications to the senior non-incapacitated member of that list in the event of a nuclear attack presumed to have removed the president from control. The possibility exists that the man to wield presidential authority in dire emergency might in fact be selected by a single field-grade military officer." The idea of a decapitation attack aimed at America's military and civilian leadership didn't seem entirely far-fetched. Indeed, it was the most plausible scenario for a Soviet attack on the United States, and it had the best chance of success. No other target system can at present offer equal potential returns from so few weapons, the report said. McNamara subsequently discovered that the command and control problems were hardly limited to the United States. We have been concerned with the vulnerability of our defense machine in the U.S., a Pentagon task force informed him, but it is nothing compared with the situation in Europe. All of NATO's command bunkers, including the operations center inside the Kinzbach cave, could easily be destroyed, even by an attack with conventional weapons. Although NATO maintained fighter planes on a ground alert, ready to take off within 15 minutes, it lacked an early warning system that could detect Soviet missiles. It also lacked a bomb alarm system. At best, NATO commanders might receive 5 or 10 minutes of warning that a Soviet attack had begun. Not enough time to get those planes off the ground. And that warning would most likely never be received because the NATO communications system was completely unprotected. Its destruction would prevent NATO from transmitting messages not only within Europe, but also between Europe and the United States. Once the fighting began, the president could not expect to reach any of NATO's high-ranking officers or to give them any orders. And they wouldn't be able to communicate with one another. The Pentagon Task Force found that NATO had done little to prepare for the devolution of command in wartime. It is imperative that each commander knows when a higher headquarters has been erased or isolated from command, that he knows his own responsibilities as the situation degrades, that he knows the status of similar commands at his level elsewhere, and that he knows the status of lower echelons and what responsibilities they can assume. It appears that this is not the case in Europe today. The absence of early warning capabilities, the poor communications, and the lack of any succession plan at NATO posed a grave, immediate risk. Not only could we initiate a war through mistakes in Europe, McNamara was told, but we could conceivably precipitate Soviet preemptive action because of a loose CNC, command and control, in Europe. The situation was made even more dangerous by the pre-delegation authority that Eisenhower had secretly granted to the military. NATO units under attack were permitted to use their nuclear weapons without awaiting presidential approval. The new National Security Advisor, McGeorge Bundy, succinctly explained the rules to President